Why are we so rich and they so poor? Why are we so rich and they so poor? This question was etched into my mind as we hopped on the church bus and drove away from the housing projects in Belgrade, Florida, and made our way back to West Palm Beach, to Palm Beach Atlantic University, which sits on the Atlantic coast. We were staying there for our mission trip, and Belgrade was only 20 minutes away. These worlds, Andy, were starkly different. And mind you, while I didn't feel rich most of the year, you know, my family lived in a very modest house nestled between LSU and South Baton Rouge. Lauren, not quite Boosie's hood, but not too far away either. Hood adjacent is what we call it. Familiar with the life in the hood and really walking distance away from it, but not close enough to experience all of the pain and desperation there. But we certainly weren't rich. My parents had five kids. My dad was a substitute teacher. My mom, who's here today, was a daycare worker. In our church context, we certainly weren't rich there either. We were one of only three black families that attended an upper-class white church on the good side of Baton Rouge, with nicely manicured lawns, huge oak trees in the front, winding roads, and plantation-style houses. We went to church and socialized with kids who were third-generation doctors or fourth-generation engineers or kids who already had businesses established in their name and stocks and bonds. We were just in middle school and high school. And to their credit, we got along okay, not perfect, and there were certainly some uncomfortable moments, some microaggressions, and lens that I wish that I would have now, that I wish I would have had then. But overall, it was fine. We got along well enough, so we saw the world pretty similarly at the time. So as we traveled on this church bus from the hood in Belgrade to the beautiful West Palm Beach, where I just run 3 miles earlier that day with the fresh smell of ocean breeze in my nose, I felt like one of those rich kids. And I asked myself again the question, why are we so rich and they so poor? I pondered the question, and then I asked one of my fellow campers, why are we so rich and they so poor? And then I asked my camp counselor as we debriefed that night, why are we so rich and they so poor? Now, the question stunned the well-meaning 21-year-old who had given up his summer to serve Christ. He said, well, Eli, that's what they were calling me that week. That's just the way it is. You know, it just sort of happens. Some are rich and some are poor. It's not a good thing or a bad thing, just a thing. Some people work harder and make a lot of money, and others, well, they didn't go to school or didn't come from a great family, so they end up in the places that we were at today. And Eli, our job is just to show them the love of Christ. We don't have to get all political or socialist about it. Just tell them that Jesus loves them. And when they get to heaven, they'll have all the riches that they need. I thought about the question for the rest of that day. Why are we so rich and they so poor? I think in our text this morning in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is wrestling with this question. Mark, that ancient scribe who some scholars believe walked and studied with St. Peter and wrote down the stories of their life together, serves as the basis for the three synoptic gospels. This story shows up in all three of these gospels, in Matthew and in Luke. In Luke, Jesus is really quick with the story, but some would say he expands on the question in the story of the Good Samaritan. In Matthew, Jesus tells the rich young ruler that he must be perfect. Here in Mark, Jesus handles it a little differently. Jesus approaches the question of money, of wealth, of economic disparity, and Jesus' followers in it all. You've heard this story before, but I'll share some of the story again. Jesus was on his way, and a man knelt before him and said, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" Y'all gonna think about this story all week. Jesus said, "No one is good except for God, but you know the commandments. Do not steal, do not murder, do not commit adultery, honor your father and mother." The man said, "I've done all of these things since I was young." And the text makes it seem like Jesus takes him seriously. He's being genuine in his response. Jesus looked at him and Jesus loved him. Jesus believed him. Jesus assessed his heart and didn't find anything else wrong with him. So he said, "One other thing you lack. Go, sell all of your possessions and give it to the poor. Then come and follow me." And listen to this part, a part that's often overlooked. Jesus continued, "And then you will have riches in heaven." You know, Maria, it's funny that Jesus tells the rich man, "Sell your stuff and you will have riches in heaven." Isn't it too often the other way? Isn't it too often the way that my camp counselor described it, that we shouldn't stress too much about the poor because their reward is in heaven? Isn't that what we told the enslaved, that they shouldn't want to be free in this life because their reward is in heaven? Isn't that what we told the poor of El Salvador tonight, to fight for equal wages because their reward is in heaven? Isn't this idea so powerful in our world that the oppressed are told to wait for their blessings while the oppressors get to enjoy it in this world? And so I think it's really funny how Jesus flips this question on his head and he tells the rich young ruler that he should sell his wealth and his reward will be in heaven. Jesus wants to redistribute wealth both in this world and eternally. He doesn't want the poor to have to wait to receive what they are due. But he presses the rich man to give up his stuff so the poor can be blessed today. Don't miss this, my friends. Jesus isn't playing. My camp counselor was really wrong. There is a need to be political and bring a radical lens to this text. In every text, Jesus recognizes the inherent injustice in telling people that their blessings will come in another life when there's plenty of abundance in this life. I know I'm talking right now. Jesus recognizes how unjust it is for homeless people to live in the nation's capital when apartments cost $2,000 to $4,000 a month and there are people that can pay, but perhaps everyone can't be guaranteed a place to live. Jesus sees that as injustice. Jesus recognizes how unjust it is for companies to take home quarterly profits in excess of hundreds of billions of dollars, and for kids in America, 20% of them, Sally, to be in poverty. Jesus recognizes how unjust our criminal justice system is and our political apparatus when it rushes to protect a wealthy white judge and no one raises their voices for black and brown teens accused in the system daily. Jesus stands before the rich young ruler whom he loves and whom he believes and whom he takes seriously and says that he must see the injustice around him. He must take account of it, and he must have an analysis of the social climate, and he must ask the question, why am I so rich and they are so poor? Jesus makes that question a prerequisite for discipleship. And before the rich young ruler can do anything else, he must sit with that question. Why am I so rich, and why are they so poor? Now, before you accuse me of setting a false binary, let me continue just a bit, because I know some of you are thinking one person's wealth isn't always connected to another person's poverty, and perhaps that's true. But we can never know the roots of social inequality unless we ask these types of questions about wealth, about privilege, about power, and hold them in a dialectical relationship with those who do not have wealth, who do not have power, who do not have privilege. One economist puts it this way: the poor do not have a monopoly on justice, but we can never understand justice without knowing the injustices of the poor. Y'all want to hear it one more time? The poor do not have a monopoly on justice, but we can never understand justice without knowing the injustice of the poor. And so the text continues, and even though the rich man can't accept his call, Jesus turns to his disciples, and Jesus attempts to teach them because they are just as stunned as the rich man, Rhea. They even though they aren't rich, they believe that being rich wasn't really a problem. So they too are stunned. Everyone in their society aspired to be rich. Everyone wanted to be rich. Everyone worked towards riches. And even if they didn't get it, that was okay because the pursuit of it was a good thing for them. So Jesus throws a wrench in their theology. Jesus shocks them when he says that it's easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get to heaven. And you can see the disciples cringing. You can hear the exasperation and anger in their voice. Their world is literally being turned upside down. As Jesus throws this wrench, you know, it's like as though they went to graduate school to get a PhD to find out that that still wouldn't make them wealthy. Or it's as though they went to law school and heard the stories of undocumented people and went to advocate for them, and now they're losing faith in the precise justice system that they wanted to reform. Or it's like they went into politics hoping to make America a better place, only to see some of the uglier roots. It's as though they're finding out for the first time that the foundation of their aspiration is an injustice. It's as though they're finding out for the first time that the foundation of their aspiration is an injustice. And so no wonder they respond to Jesus with force and amazement, because if there is no hope for the rich person, then they ask Jesus, who then can be saved? We've left everything for you. And they really are saying that in the end, shouldn't there be a pot of gold at the end of this road of discipleship? See, despite everything that the Old Testament said about abuse of power and wealth and money, the prevailing mindset was that those who financed the temple, those who financed the synagogues, those who gave jobs to the peasants and alms to the poor, they were all more favored by God. And so Jesus disrupts their thinking. Jesus disrupts their society. Jesus disrupts their economy. Jesus disturbs them. And if we are honest, Jesus disturbs us too. He pushes the rich man, he pushes the disciples, and he pushes us to consider the question, why are we so rich and they so poor? Or why are we so poor and they so rich? Look, let's just be real for a minute. Jesus doesn't let any of us get away from this social analysis. Jesus knows that as much as the rich have perpetuated the lie that their wealth has nothing to do with the poverty in the world, a lot of the poor and middle class aspire to be rich and believe that their poverty has nothing to do with the riches in this world. A lot of us are swimming and drowning in myths about hard work and bootstraps and entitlements and divine blessings, and Jesus is trying his hardest to undo it all. And the question is, will we let him? Or will we be like the rich young ruler who is so attached to our status that we miss the call on our lives? Will we be like the rich young ruler who was so attached to our status that we missed the call on our lives? Will we be like the rich young ruler who is so attached to our status that we miss the call on our lives. See, he could have been a really phenomenal disciple of Jesus. There were other disciples of Jesus who also had a lot of money. He also seemed honest and stable and genuine. He could have balanced out some of the other quirks of the other disciples. But his privileged status was something he could not give up for discipleship. And so many of us are like that. We are genuine and good and sincere, and Jesus deeply loves us. Jesus has placed a call on our lives. Jesus has extended an invitation to us, but we cannot say yes to the invitation because we fear that we will lose our status in this world. And I know I'm talking to someone, but don't pass up the call that Jesus has put on your life because you are attached to your status. Please ask the question. Ask the question about unfair treatment and injustice. Ask the question about race and gender and power and privilege. Ask the question about who we believe and who we trust and why we believe and why we trust. Ask the question personally. Ask it of this church. Ask it in society. Why am I so rich and they so poor? You know, this question came up in a book that I was reading from my African political thought class, and I know y'all didn't think I was going to go a whole semester without quoting my professors. My professor, Dr. Wilfred David, said this: after 40 years of working at the World Bank and advising African leaders and advising European and American leaders on international development and international relations, he realized that the question of why are we so rich and they so poor never came up. And so he raised it in his own book. It dissatisfied him, so he built on the work of the Swedish political economist, I'm almost done, y'all, Professor Göran Hayden, who proposed examining the economic system of peasants in East Africa. There, Professor Hayden realized that in the structure of their society, and Rick, if you can hear me, you'll like this, was a social and economic resistance to capitalism, what he called the economy of affection. The economy of affection, an economic and social system in which both villagers and city dwellers were tied together in a web of kinships and tribal obligations that mitigated against the acclimation of wealth and capital that led to class-based society. Hayden claimed that these relationships, that for them, relationships were so highly valued and cared for that it drove their society and it kept their peasants powerful. This mode of organizing was based on two principles: one, a principle of reciprocity, and the other, a principle of dignity. The wealthy would see the dignity in the poor, and the poor would see the dignity in themselves. And my professor built on this argument, and he said at the heart of this was Ubuntu, the African ideal where everyone knows their worth. And it's not just about what you can do, but about who you are as a child of God. This idea recognized and argued with the capitalist principle that human nature, human instinct is more than just looking out for yourself, but that instead a mutual well-being can drive society. There's enough for everyone to eat, everyone to have, everyone to do. The economy of affection. And if we look very closely, I think Jesus is advocating for something like the economy of affection to take shape with his disciples then and now. See, as the story continues and his disciples despair about their ability to get rich, Jesus responds to them that he sees what they have already done. He ensures them that no one who accepts the call, who leaves father and mother, sister and brother, will not receive what they need in this life and the life to come. In her commentary on this text, Dr. Phoebe Parkins says that Jesus can make this promise to the disciples because there are two invitations for every disciple. One is an invitation of radical sacrifice, the one that he asks of the rich young ruler, And the other is an invitation of radical generosity. Some are called, like the rich young ruler, to give up all that they have and follow Jesus into the unknown. But others are called to be abundantly generous to those who have already answered the call. And together, there's enough for everyone. Enough for those who need to be out there to be radical and not have to worry about what they have to eat. And when we answer this call, this two-natured call, we get closer to Ubuntu, closer to the economy of affection, closer to the life that Jesus imagined for his followers, closer to life where we make sense of the question, why are we so rich and they so poor? We get closer to figuring all of this out, but because we see that in one way or another, our wealth is connected to theirs, and their poverty is connected to ours, but that is not the only way. Jesus promises his disciple, and he promises us that although this is a way of ordering and redistributing, and he asks that this is indeed possible with God. It's possible if we are willing to earnestly discern the call upon our lives and trust how God is moving. See, my friends, if the rich young ruler had been more okay with this call, he would have learned that he actually would have been okay. Selling all of his things wouldn't mean that he would have to be hungry or poor or naked or without food. He would have had enough. And I hope you can see that, my friends, that God has enough for everyone. And when God disrupts our thinking and disrupts our society and disrupts our deterministic economic thought, God invites everyone to participate in a reordering of the world where there is enough. And those of us who have been powerful and wealthy and privileged won't be punished into poverty or banished into the divine exile. We will be included in God's radical abundance. My friends, God desires the church to perhaps be an economy of affection, that we might mirror back to the world that there is another way, where all of us are fed and all of us can eat, where all of us can live and all of us can bring our talents and our gifts, where all of us are welcome and all of us can be joyful and all of us can be comforted and all of us can love. Jesus desires our participation in the economy of affection, where relationships with one another and relationships with God and relationship to this earth and relationships to the vulnerable are the animating features of this society. When we feel the risk of the call, the heaviness of divesting, God is also telling us that we will be okay, and God is inviting us to participate. Okay, I'm done. In the economy of affection. My friend, the call is before us. We know what the prerequisites are. Will we follow Jesus and experience abundant life together in the economy of affection?